Macon was a tired old town, even in 1932 when I first knew it. Somehow it was hotter then. Men's stiff collars wilted by 9 in the morning. Ladies bathed before noon, after their 3 o'clock naps. And by nightfall were like soft tea cakes with frostings of sweat and sweet talcum. The day was 24 hours long, but it seemed longer. There was no hurry, for there was nowhere to go, nothing to buy, no money to buy it with. Although Macon County had recently been told that it had nothing to fear but fear itself. That summer, I was 6 years old.
To Kill a Mockingbird, the book celebrates its 50th anniversary this year, and we talk about the book, how influential it has been, one of the most influential books, many will say only second to the Bible, in the last few hundred years. Charles Shields is the author of Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee, and we'll be meeting him in a moment. And joining us sometime this hour, Mary Badham, the actress who portrayed Scout in the film To Kill a Mockingbird. She says that this film defined her life and taught her tolerance and so many other things, and says that ignorance, racism, and bigotry are still around. They've just changed their clothes. We welcome your phone calls during the course of this hour as well. I have spent much of the weekend immersed in To Kill a Mockingbird, watching the film and reading the book by Charles and talking about the influence of this marvelous movie, which ranks way up there as close to my all-time favorite, as I'm sure it is for many of you as well. We will be welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. You may also send emails, talk@WPR.org. And I know some of you have already left messages for our guests on Facebook, and you can follow along on Facebook as well, which now has a great listing, thanks to you, of all kinds of books for summer reading. So I urge you to go there. Charles Shields joins us at the top of the hour. He is the author of the New York Times bestseller Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee. Charles is a former teacher. He's been a reporter for public radio, a journalist, and the author of nonfiction books for young people. He resides in Virginia, and we're very delighted to have him with us the first part of our program. Later today, Mary Badham will join us, the actress who played Scout in the film To Kill a Mockingbird. Hello, Charles. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you wrote the book. I learned so much more, and we're hungry for information about Harper Lee, who hasn't given an interview, I guess, since 1964. But you talked to almost everybody in the world who knew her, didn't you?
I know. You know, it became almost an oral history in the sense that I had to talk to her elementary school classmates and her college classmates, her fraternity, her sorority sisters, all sorts of different people. And it was difficult getting information, of course, because I had to corroborate what I found out with someone else who could tell me the same thing. So when I needed an answer to an ordinary question like, how much did she smoke when she was a young woman, I had to get two or three people to agree that she was a chain smoker. So many things I could have just asked her directly, I had to find out from a lot of other people.
Yeah, a chain smoker. She also smoked cigars, didn't she?
Yes, she was. Yes, she did.
Yeah. She had this streak, and she's portrayed so well in the film, of being a real rebel in terms of her language and her clothing, and she wasn't influenced by people around her necessarily, even in the sorority. She was hard to believe that Harper Lee was in a sorority, but she followed her own tune.
Yes, you know, the little girl you see in To Kill a Mockingbird, Scout, is Harper Lee in miniature. I mean, that little girl is a nonconformist. She doesn't look over her shoulder for approval. She goes her own way. And that is the template for Nell Harper Lee, the author of the book. Everyone I spoke to said that she's just describing herself. That's part of the reason why she has moved away from the public spotlight. She is not enamored of celebrity. She values her privacy, and she'd rather do what she wants to do.
Mm-hmm. And what about that second book? Do you imagine that we won't see it, that she's probably finished it by now or very close to it, and we will not see the manuscript until after her death?
Well, there was a second book that she worked on. It was sort of an in cold blood treatment of a Southern Alabama preacher who was the beneficiary on people's insurance policies in his congregation. And four or five of them died mysteriously, and he came into a lot of money. Finally, a relative of someone shot him dead. She wrote probably maybe a third of that book, but the problem was that the preacher was very unsympathetic as a character. You see, the magic of In Cold Blood is that you tend to become sort of enchanted by Dick and Perry, the two killers. They're smart, they're charismatic, but this preacher was nothing like that, so she dropped the project. I have heard, however, that she has written another book, and it's with her agent, with the instructions that it's not to be published until after her death.
Oh, really?
Because she doesn't want the publicity. I mean, if something were to come out now from Harper Lee, that little town she lives in, Monroeville, Alabama, her hometown would be inundated with journalists.
And probably most people don't, because she's been so reclusive, don't realize that she's still alive or that she still lives in that little town with her, 98-year-old sister.
Yes, Alice Lee goes into the law offices 3 days a week of Bug, Barnett, and Lee. She's known as the tax lady of Monroeville. And although she's deaf as a post, she still does people's taxes. She's the last remaining partner of that law firm. That lady is so old that she wrote me a lovely description of what it was like celebrating the end of World War I in Monroeville when the doughboys came home.
Oh, my. It's hard for me to think of Harper Lee without thinking of Scout. And I think that many of us are like that, that we think that she was Scout during her whole life. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the book is told through the viewpoint of Scout. Do you think from what you've learned about her that, indeed, she is a grown-up Scout?
Yes. Yeah, very much so. As I said earlier, she's a nonconformist, and she pretty much marches to her own drummer. That's not to say, though, that she is, ill-mannered or impolite. She can be quite charming, and she's very warm. In fact, if she hadn't helped Truman Capote in Kansas, he wouldn't have penetrated that little town. Because, Truman went out there dressed in a beret and a long coat and moccasins, thinking that was an appropriate
right.
Western look, and was walking up to these cattle farmers and asking them, "Can you tell me about the murdered family?" And they had no interest in talking to him. They thought he was some kind of ghoul. So the little man whose last name they mispronounced as Capucci or Capote wasn't doing well, but he had this nice lady with him who was, friendly and a good conversationalist, and they opened up to her. In fact, in my book, I mentioned the fact that in Truman's files, there are 150 single-spaced typewritten pages of notes taken by Harper Lee while she was out there in Kansas with Truman, and he relied heavily on her research. In many places, in his own notes, he'll say at the bottom in his own little penciled handwriting, CNL's notes. For a better discussion of what happened, what they saw.
So why didn't he give her, at one point in your book, you say that she, or maybe she said this, she wrote half the book, and yet he did not give her credit. He dedicated the book to her, but that was about it.
Truman was very jealous. Truman loved attention. He sort of had a hole in him. His parents dropped him in Monroeville when he was a little boy to go off and live the high life. They loved parties. They loved people. And Truman was a ball and chain to them, anyway. And so they dropped him there. And he's the character Dill in To Kill a Mockingbird who keeps saying, "My folks don't want me." And that was true. They didn't. So Truman spent his life trying to validate himself and, to have people like him. And lo and behold, the little girl next door who wears overalls wins the Pulitzer Prize. And she's not particularly, all that enamored of it. I mean, it's not that big a deal with her. She's more excited that she's written a book that honors her father. Truman just saw this as another example of the world's injustice. Somebody who really doesn't care about getting it gets it. And then he wasn't nominated for the Pulitzer Prize or the National Book Award for In Cold Blood. So, yes, the book is dedicated to Harper Lee, but in a perfect world, it would be In Cold Blood by Truman Capote with Harper Lee.
Right, which is how it should have been.
Yes.
Tell me about the process of writing this book. She went to New York to write this, and it was a long process, and it was due to her New York family, her family of friends, that she was allowed to spend the time that was necessary to write this book.
Right. Well, you know, you make a good point when you bring up about the importance of her going to New York. Harper Lee couldn't have written To Kill a Mockingbird if she had stayed down there in southern Alabama, because the scales fell from her eyes when she went to the big city. You see, she grew up in a little segregated town where there was kind of a symbiotic relationship between the blacks and the whites. In those Jim Crow days, when there was something called Negro law, blacks weren't allowed in town except on weekends. And if they were seen on the street during the week, they should have a note from somebody saying who they were working for. I mean, imagine a world like that. And so she moves to New York, and she interacts with people who are from all over the world, with various accents, who have all kind of ethnic backgrounds, and she saw a much larger world, and she saw her little town in perspective for what it was. Now, when she thought about what she could write about, she was smart enough to follow that advice that's given to young writers, which is write about what you know. So she wrote about being the daughter of an attorney in a little southern town, and that's what she stuck to writing about. But as you say, she had friends who rallied around her. She made friends with people who were savvy about the publishing world, who were supportive, particularly her editor, Tay Hohoff, a woman in her 60s, who guided her through three entire drafts of the book because she could not get it right. She didn't know how to write a novel. She knew how to write entertaining sort of sketches of life in the South, but she couldn't create that arc that would carry you through 60,000 words.
Equally influential, well, not equally, because it's amazing how influential both are. So I wouldn't say equally, because the book is going to be around for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting to read about her involvement in the film and how that film group became this family, many of them, that continued long after the film was made. It is also just I've seen it twice now in the last month, and I've watched it I don't know how many times in my lifetime, as I'm sure you have. It's one of the places where the movie really gets a good understanding of what the book is. I think it's a beautiful and very important movie.
Yes, it was one of those wonderful situations where all the right elements came together. You see, the big studios didn't want to touch it. They didn't think it was a very interesting film or a very interesting book. It wasn't one they thought that would translate well onto the screen. They thought it was more of an art house sort of movie. Mm-hmm. Because after all, these are the days when Westerns like Ride the High Country, you know, and things like that were being made with Randolph Scott. And along comes an idea for a social crisis in a small southern town. And they didn't want it. In fact, they wanted to cast Rock Hudson in the role of
Atticus. I know. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
Rock
I know.
Hudson.
Yeah, and then Bing Crosby threw his hat in the ring and said he wanted to play it. And Harper Lee's agent said, well, Bing Crosby can play Atticus provided he doesn't wear a collar and sing.
Right.
So what happened was Gregory Peck read the novel and all stayed up all one night reading it and called up the director who only writes to it and said, listen, I'm in, and if you're having money problems, I'll help pay. So he paid for half of the film, which gave him some creative control over the movie as well. Now, if you watch it carefully, it's really kind of a low-budget film. You know, there's about three major sets. It's in black and white, and it's not because they didn't know about color in 1962. It's they couldn't afford it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they couldn't afford any other big-name actors on the set, so they got Broadway actors, a lot of unknowns, including Robert Duvall, who was a young, hungry actor and plays Boo Radley. He stayed out of the sun for about 6 weeks to look pale and dyed his hair blonde. So it was sort of a community effort, but the real genius behind the movie, and when all said and done, was Horton Foote. Because Horton Foote was raised in a little Texas town, and he had Alabama relatives, and he knew how to create the feel of a little town like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he won an Academy Award for that script.
We are going to welcome phone calls, and we have parts of the movie that we would like to hear. We're hopeful that Mary Badham will be joining us, too, in this program, the actress who played Scout in the film To Kill a Mockingbird. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Our guest, Charles Shields, author of Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To Kill a Mockingbird, celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, and the film we're talking about as well was released in 1962. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and we start our phone calls for Charles Shields with Adam from Prentice. Hi, Adam.
Pardon that noise. Good morning.
Hi.
I didn't see the movie, but I did read the book. It's a simply marvelous book. You know, when I first started, I remember thinking it reminded me sort of Huckleberry Finn, written by Mark Twain, because of all the Southernisms in it. It's very densely packed. You know, to my way of thinking, it's primarily about the culture and the legal system of the Old South, which, of course, in those days was run by the Democrat Party. I think you see in the book that it's awful hard on the poor white people, too. It's not just blacks. I just remember Robert E. Lee Ewell. You know, what an awful character that guy was. But think what it would be like basically living on top of a garbage dump in a way that's described. I mean, you can just picture it in your mind's eye. But what I wanted to talk about was that Atticus Finch gives a little speech before the jury where he talks about how grand the legal system was in those days. In other words, you know, it's the only place where a poor man can get a fair break, and it's, I think he uses the phrase, it's the ultimate leveler in American society. It doesn't matter if you have a lot of money or if you're poor, you'll still be treated fairly and have your rights observed. And frankly, I think society has improved a lot, but I think the legal system has actually begun to gone downhill. I mean,
all right, thanks. Thanks very much, Adam, for your call. We do have. Do you want to set this up for us, Charles? We do have that part of the movie which is so moving. Part of Atticus's speech in the courtroom.
Atticus is making his summation to the jury. 12 white men who are property donors, which, you know, those were the qualifications for being on a jury in those days. And what your caller points out is true. He is asking them to rise to the level of what American justice should be. He's not talking about Southern justice. He's talking about the legal system in its purest form, and he wants them to become that, to embody that. So go ahead.
She's committed no crime. She has merely broken a rigid and time-honored code of our society. A code so severe that whoever breaks it is hounded from our midst, is unfit to live with. She must destroy the evidence of her offense. But what was the evidence of her offense? Tom Robinson, a human being. She must put Tom Robinson away from her. Tom Robinson was to her a daily reminder of what she did. Now, what did she do? She tempted a Negro. She was white, and she tempted a Negro. She did something that in our society is unspeakable. She kissed a black man. Not an old uncle, but a strong, young Negro man.
Charles Shields, our guest. That voice, I've never just heard the voice without seeing the movie, and as Rhonda was preparing portions of the movie for our show, I realized how powerful that voice is. It is absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, I know. He's a Solomon, isn't he?
Yes.
I mean, you know, it's very dramatic. It's almost biblical in its
yes.
weightiness. And what he's talking about is the collision between custom and justice. And, you know, he's talking about, yeah, we do things a certain way here, but that's not what is at issue. We're in a courtroom, and all those things must be left at the door. But they can't do that. They don't rise to the occasion. They find him guilty because they have to make an example of it.
And when you say it's almost biblical, that's interesting because the book is thought of as almost biblical by many people, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Because it inspires people to ask what they stand for. You know, that's the mark of a great piece of literature, is that it reads you as you read it.
Hmm.
I mean, there's many pieces of things, there's many, you know, works of fiction that we read that we leave on an airplane seat or a park bench, and we enjoyed the time that we spent with it, but it hasn't changed us. But great works of literature ask you, what would I do? You know, could I make that moral choice? Your caller earlier referred to Huck Finn. It's a perfect parallel because, you know, after Jim, the runaway slave, is taken away by slaveholders and Huck is left alone on the raft, he has to decide whether he's going to continue down the river to safety or whether he's going to go back and get his friend. Now, he's been told since his childhood that helping a runaway slave is wrong, that you'll go to hell for it. And finally, he says out loud to himself, well, I'll just go to hell. And he starts making for the bank, you know, to help his friend. And you have to, you know, when you read things about moral choices, you're engaged. It touches your heart.
I think that, let me find this part of the book. The importance of, it seems to me as though there's one main character in this book, and it's Atticus, although certainly Scout, it's told through her eyes. And,
right. You know, the book was called Atticus at first. That was her working title. That was the name of the book because that was her male hero. That was the adult. But her editor persuaded her that people will get confused. You know, people only spend about 15 seconds looking at a book in a bookstore before they move on. And the title Atticus connotes Cicero, Greece, ancient history. But there's nothing like to kill a mockingbird. Kill was very powerful, and mockingbird says south.
Right. I love Atticus. That would have been a nice, although there's nothing like to kill a mockingbird. See, I mean, that just says a whole lot. But I like Atticus as well. And that one thing, which is fairly simple, but when he's telling Scout about having to understand somebody else walking around in somebody's shoes, which is something that we use all the time now, and maybe it was made more prominent because of that particular story. But how important that is to walk around in somebody else's shoes.
It's a fundamental principle of empathy, and it's something that you can practice all the time. To Kill a Mockingbird is a highly dramatic situation, all right? And when I go to high schools today, I see all kinds of faces looking back at me from all walks of life, all kinds of kids. To them, racial issues are not as important as they were to my generation and probably your generation. But we face a whole new set of challenges when it comes to religious tolerance, understanding other people's worldviews, understanding how people can die for their beliefs.
Yes.
And while, you know, I'm not arguing that we should, you know, condone that kind of thing or be relativistic and say, well, that's what they think, nevertheless, to grant them some measure of tolerance, we at least have to try to understand what they believe.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls, too. I don't mean to keep you out of our conversation. Joining us is Charles Shields, author of Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee. I know that many of you have treasured this book for a long time, and it's been extraordinarily influential in your life. We'd love to hear from you this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you're welcome to do that. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We are hopeful that, I would be very disappointed if she didn't. We're very hopeful that Mary Badham, who played Scout, will be joining us.
I can tell you about Mary. She's lovely.
I don't know where she is, but we hope she'll join us. She seems to be absolutely lovely.
She is. Yes. Mary and I and Phil Alford, who played Jim, had lunch together in Monroeville, as a matter of fact. And the movie made a tremendous amount of difference to them in both their lives. You know, it was really brilliant how that film used them as children. They both grew up in Birmingham, so they didn't have to be coached on the accent at all. That's just the way they spoke. And the director would simply have them play for a little while. And after they really sort of, you know, broke a sweat and got interested in what they were doing, he would say, okay, now say your lines. And they would integrate, you know, what they were doing with their play. So there was no going from cold to hot. There was just being children and then saying the pretend lines. Mary one time said that it was like being under an overturned bowl of glass, and everybody could look in and watch you.
And the other story of how influential it was, and you love hearing these stories because obviously the words that they were speaking and the way the film was directed and handled was important to all of them, because these people became friends forever. I love the story of Gregory Peck being given Harper Lee's father's watch, and he's holding on to it and sort of fiddling with it before he receives the Academy Award, and that he becomes a surrogate father to Mary, who's lost her mother early and her father, and that Brock gives the eulogy. It almost makes you cry now at Gregory Peck's funeral. Yeah. This was important to all of them.
Yes. Peck set the standard by starting out right in the creation of this movie. He went to Monroeville to see who he was supposed to play and the way they lived. He sat down with Mr. Lee, and Mr. Lee had never seen Gregory Peck in a movie. Mr. Lee was a man who was immersed in books and the law and his friendships, and he found Gregory Peck charming, and they talked for about an hour, and Peck, being the consummate actor that he is, picked up on Lee's mannerisms. And people in Monroeville say that it's uncanny when you watch Peck on the screen, because Mr. Lee fumbles with his watch. And Mr. Lee would sometimes pause and sort of harumph while he was waiting for the right word to come to him. And that you're seeing what Harper Lee's father looked like.
Let's go to more phone calls for you. Let's go to Martha from Dubuque next. Hello, Martha.
Good morning, and thanks for what a great program. Thanks for taking my phone call. I just have two comments, and one is as soon as I heard the program and I was tuning in, I got on my my cell phone and texted my daughter, who's at work, and asked her if she read the book or seen the movie. And I did the same thing with my son, who just graduated from high school. My daughter's in college, and they both have read the book, and they both saw the movie, and they read the book. I just wanted to clarify to make sure that I had the information right. They read it in high school, in, you know, a literature class. Mm-hmm. And I was scolded by my son and my daughter as well, because we had, you know, conversation a long, long time ago, and they said, "You need to read this book, Mother," because in my day, I went to a private high school, a parochial high school, and, you know, education has changed so much. I never read it, and I wasn't much of a reader. So they both have said, "You need to read this book, Mother." And I totally agree with the author about, you know, racism and how it brings up that conversation. And I think that's so important for our kids today to engage in that, especially in education. But this program has inspired me to go out and get that book and bring it home and have it in my home library. So
yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks very much for your call.
Well, the book is taught in 2/3 of American public high schools, and that's, you know, how widespread its influence is. And the interesting thing about it is the book changes as you grow older. When you read To Kill a Mockingbird as a 13 or 14-year-old, you know, in the 9th grade or 10th grade, you're intrigued with getting Boo Radley to come out of his house. And who is this American Frankenstein who lives down the street? And then when you read it when you're in your 30s or 40s, you become intrigued with the neighborhood and the Ladies Missionary Society, you know, that's so hypocritical. They're hilarious. And the legal system, which is dysfunctional. And, you know, your vision of what this book is changes. And I've had people come up to me afterward and say, "You know, I read that book 30 years apart, and I wondered to myself, am I reading the same book?" You've changed. The book hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm. She was very good, Harper Lee, to the town, wasn't she? She put a lot of money to get in a new Methodist church and really spiffed up a lot of places. It was home.
Well, I have to disagree with you there. Harper Lee, Monroeville is excited about having Harper Lee as their resident and their favorite daughter. And they're equally excited about having Truman Capote, you know, having grown up there. Monroeville has dubbed itself the literary capital of Alabama. But Harper Lee is a rather flinty person, and she's very litigious about that book. When some high school kids painted a mural on the side of a building depicting a scene from To Kill a Mockingbird. She pronounced it was graffiti. And when the local historical museum put together something called Calpurnia's Cookbook, which was an assemblage of recipes from all over town that they were going to sell to support the museum, they received a letter from an attorney saying they had to pulp all 5,000 copies or they were going to be sued, which they did. Her belief is that the book should remain where it is in the 1930s, and the characters should never be brought into the present. I mean, we're not going to see Scout Lee or you know, Scout Finch on the side of a lunchbox anytime soon.
Right.
And she just, you know, that's the integrity that she wants to stay with the book. And there's also a clause in her contract with the movie company that no one will ever play Harp, will play Atticus except Gregory Peck in her lifetime.
Oh, my. But didn't she rebuild the church and give a lot of money to the town?
Well, no, she has not given a lot of money to the town. She gives 10% of her income to the Methodist Church, and she did help rehab the church as well. Her father was a deacon for the local Methodist Church. But Monroe is still, like it's described in To Kill a Mockingbird, kind of a dusty old town. And they could just kick themselves for destroying a lot of their heritage after World War II. You know, after the war, new was good and old was bad and corny. Consequently, a lot of the old houses were allowed to go to rack and ruin, and at one point there was a talk about tearing down the old courthouse. Fortunately, some local people got together and saved it. Otherwise, there'd be no courthouse to see. And I'll tell you, you go in there, and it's as holy as a church. People whisper inside.
Let's go to another call. Tina from Madison. Hi, Tina.
Hi, thanks for the program, and I'm really looking forward to reading this book. I just wanted to say that this book affected me so profoundly when I was a young girl, probably 8th grade or 7th grade, and my two sons, high school and college age now, also love the book, and we also think it's one of the few movies that's worth watching after you've read a phenomenal book. And when Gregory Peck died a few years ago, one of my sons said, Mom, he called me and said, Mom, Atticus has passed. And it was just, I think it really spoke to me to how profoundly this book has touched people. And I really agree with the author about how it changes over the course of a lifetime. And one thing I also wanted to say is it's interesting to see how many, I've run into probably 5 or 6 little girls named Scout in the last 10 or 15 years.
Have you?
And at one school, I'm not even kidding, there was a little girl named Scout and a little boy named Atticus in the same 4th grade classroom.
Oh.
Which I think was just phenomenal. So thank you for the program and thanks for writing that book. I'm
thank
looking
you.
Forward to reading it.
Thanks for the call.
Yes, and a lot of little girls named Harper, too. You were talking earlier about Harper Lee living in Monroeville. Part of her shyness about coming forward in her role as author and about the book is the fact that the town was not all that receptive to the novel when it came out. You know, To Kill a Mockingbird wasn't taught in Monroeville until 1984. And the reason for that is that a lot of people thought that they could recognize characters in the book, and some actually argued that it didn't reflect very well on the town. So there's always been a bit of a tension between the author and her hometown.
And you can see why. She's dealing with some big subjects.
Yes, she is. She received a lot of mail from people after the book came out saying, well, you've really given northern liberals ammunition to ruin us. I remember one letter in particular said, why don't you write a book about whites stacking up blacks like cordwood? That'd make you $1 million.
Here's an email. People were talking about naming their children after Scout and Atticus. Which is a wonderful thing, and some of us have beloved pets, too. Sally Taylor writes, so looking forward to the show today. Over the years, I've had beloved pets, Scout, Atticus, Calpurnia, and Radley. Oh, and Jem, G-E-M. I did a variation on the spelling, she says. To Kill a Mockingbird was one of the very few movies we were allowed to stay up late and watch back in the day when the good movies came on late, and there was no such thing as recording them.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You know, there was an interesting remark that one of your earlier callers made about Yule. We should talk about poor whites at that time and where the anger comes from. The reason, excuse me, The reason that the Ku Klux Klan was able to enlarge its numbers, increase its numbers so vastly during the Great Depression was their pitch came down to this. White people, you have, particularly poor white people, you have fallen below the level that you once enjoyed. You are now no longer as self-sufficient as you once were. You are no longer respected as you once were. The reason for Tom Ewell's hatred of Tom Robinson, or his name is Bob Ewell, I think, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The reason he hates Tom Robinson is that Robinson is respected, and he has a job. And, you know, he other people like him. And Ewell hunts out of season. He the law ignores him because if he isn't allowed to hunt out of season, he won't be able to feed his family. So, you know, he feels that he is a man who has come down unjustly, and he's not going to stand for this. In fact, it's very interesting. He refers to Atticus as Captain. A couple times he says, well, what are you talking about, Captain? That's what all Confederate soldiers used to call all Confederate officers. They wouldn't call them by their rank. They just referred to all of them above them as Captain. He's a deep South Southerner, and for him the war has never ended.
And a method actor, difficult to get along with. I believe you write that the director said, listen, you got to stay off the liquor when you do this show. But he was always in character, and he was lucky he got the part in terms of work, right?
Yes, by and large, he was that man. He was a method actor. He was a Southerner. Unfortunately, he drank a lot, and the director said, I want your hand, and I want you to shake my hand and commit to the fact that you'll be on time and you will respect the other people and do what I say. He was there, all right, but he was not easy to get along with, and sparks flew between him and Peck. At one point, Peck tried to give him some advice, and the actor said, look, you don't tell me what to do.
Let's pause for a moment. Our guest this hour is Charles Shields, author of Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee. We're celebrating the 50th anniversary of To Kill a Mockingbird this hour of the program. That music is beautiful too, isn't it? Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about To Kill a Mockingbird this hour of the program, and our guest is the author of Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee, Charles Shields. We have bits from the movie. I guess I'm assuming that everybody has seen this movie or read the book, which is not entirely the case, but many more will, perhaps, after this show. Can you set this up for it? I love this piece, and it was, we'd hoped to have Scout with us, but this influential speech where she's confronting, Tom Robinson is in jail, and she's confronting a group of perhaps Klansmen who have come to probably beat him up.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom Robinson is in jail for the alleged assault on a white girl, a poor white girl named Mayella. And Atticus, suspecting trouble, has camped out, in effect, outside the courthouse doors. He has a light on over him, and he's reading. And a bunch of Model T Fords pull up, and local farmers get out. You know, no hoods or masks or anything. And they tell him in so many words, get out of the way. We're going to do what has to be done.
Now, you get him out of here, Mr. Finch.
Jim, I want you to please leave.
No, sir.
Jim?
Tell you I ain't going.
Hey, Mr. Cunningham. I said, hey, Mr. Cunningham. How's your entailment getting along? Don't you remember me, Mr. Cunningham? I'm Jean Louise Finch. You brought us some hickory nuts one early morning, remember? We had a talk. I went and got my daddy to come out and thank you. I go to school with your boy. I go to school with Walter. He's a nice boy. Tell him hey for me, won't you? You know something, Mr. Cunningham? Entailments are bad. Entailments Atticus, I was just saying to Mr. Cunningham that entanglements were bad, but not to worry. Takes a long time sometimes. What's the matter? I sure meant no harm, Mr. Cunningham.
No harm taken, young lady. I'll tell Walter you said hey. Let's clear out of here. Let's go, boys.
That's one of my favorite scenes in the movie, I think.
Yes, but, you know, I forgot to mention that Scout and Jim and Dill show up outside the courthouse steps and suddenly appear in this very tense situation. And Scout just begins talking to one of the men she recognizes, Mr. Cunningham. And I asked the psychologist, why does that work? How come this child, you know, is able to disband a group of angry men with guns? He said, the way to defuse a mob is to individualize them. You see, when they first show up, they're just a bunch of, you know, of hardworking men, some of whom are probably not literate, but they know what they like and what they don't like, and they're going to take the law in their own hands. But Scout steps up, and she says, hey, Mr. Cunningham, how's your son doing? He's a nice boy.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, you know, the facade drops away. They're neighbors. They're community members. And after this little exchange, Cunningham says, okay, boys, let's go.
Right.
And they get in their cars and they go.
Yeah. Let's take some more phone calls. Dave is our next caller from West Bend. Hello, Dave.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, you?
Good, thanks. Something I love about that last scene is it's so funny and so beautiful because Scout has taken one of Atticus's lessons from earlier in the novel when he has made a young poor boy named Walter Cunningham feel at home by asking him questions about farming. And Scout and Jem are totally in left field, and Walter himself feels like a man in the House of the Finches.
Exactly.
I teach in Istanbul, and I've been teaching To Kill a Mockingbird to Turkish students for the last 6 years in ninth grade. And once they get past the convolution of the first couple of pages, they really fall in love with the book. And something I say is that by the end of this book, you should be a better person, at least for a couple of weeks, because, as you said before, it is like a Bible. It's so quotable, and it generally makes me a better person.
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted to ask was, for you and your guest, what do you think the movie missed, if anything? For me, it's the exclusion of Auntie Alexandra, who's such a beautiful foil to Atticus, and as well as Jem's moments with Mr. Bose. Thanks.
Thank you so much. And they cut that from the film, didn't they, Jem's moments?
Yes, Mr. Bose, the famous scenes involving Mr. Bose are actually were shot, but they were dropped due to length. And also because Gregory Peck wanted less emphasis on the children and more emphasis on him as the protagonist. There's the famous scenes in the book where Jem, as a punishment, is told that he must read to Mr. Bose out loud from Ivanhoe because he's destroyed her flowers. And they did shoot all that, but it was dropped. That's gone, and Aunt Alexandra, as your caller said, is gone. Aunt Alexandra comes to help Atticus cope as he's going through this trial, help be a sort of a surrogate mother. In fact, Aunt Alexandra is about the closest you're ever going to get to Harper Lee's mother. Harper Lee's mother is not in the book because she was a manic depressive. And Harper Lee didn't know exactly what to expect from a mother like that. At times, she was very warm, and other times, she was so distant, she didn't recognize people. And so she's not in the book at all as a result. But Anna Alexander is like Mrs. Lee in that Harper Lee said that Miss Anna Alexander was very broad from the back, opinionated, and had boarding school manners, and her mother attended a boarding school.
Let's go to Tristan next from Evansburg. Hi, Tristan.
Hi, I'm calling. Thank you for putting me on, and I'm actually reading To Kill a Mockingbird for my freshman class next year in high school.
Great.
Yeah, and I was wondering, what was Harper Lee's inspiration for writing about Bob Ewell?
Okay.
What was her inspiration? Well, Bob Ewell can represent a lot of different people. People have asked me, you know, is he anyone in particular? No, he represents about any angry, poor white person who feels that the system has failed him and he has been unjustly treated. He's not getting what he deserves in life by virtue of his skin color. And therefore, he is sort of a one-man posse. But he could be anybody.
And thank you very much for the call. We do have Mary Badham with us now, and we're happy to have her with us the last few minutes of the program. She, of course, is the actress who played Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird. And I know that many of you have sent Facebook messages about her and would also like to talk with her in the remaining few minutes. We'll keep you on with us, Charles, as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Hello, Mary. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello.
Hi.
Talk to you.
Oh, it's great to have you here. I think it was last week or was it the week before? You had a three-day read-in of To Kill a Mockingbird that you participated in?
Yes, down in Monroeville. It was amazing. And we had people there from all over the world, Poland and Canada and Egypt and oh, I don't know where all. It was just amazing, and we had just hundreds and hundreds of people show up for the event, which just thrilled us no end.
Oh, I would imagine. I would love to have been there. You talk about the fact that this movie, that this story really defined your life in many ways. Can you talk more about that? It did. It defined, well, it defined the course of your life, but also perhaps what your values are.
Oh, definitely. You know, it really helped to mold what my parents had put into place already, you know, but it really helped to solidify that and, you know, helped me to grow. And as the country grew and changed, you know, it really has been quite a force in my life.
It was wonderful to read the relationships that developed among the cast members in the film. Gregory Peck, is it fair to say, became a surrogate father to you?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Because I lost my dad real early. I lost my mom like 3 weeks after I graduated from high school, and I lost my dad like 2 years after I got married. So I got married when I was 21. So that's very young to lose your parents. And you know, the Pecks were so dear and kind that they would keep up with me and call and check on me and make sure everything was okay, along with Brock Peters, who played Tom Robinson in the film. You know, they really, I tell people I had reverse Oreo daddies because I had two white daddies and one black daddy. But it was great. I mean, they were so kind and so dear. You know, people so important to take their time to pick up the phone and call or write me a note of encouragement. You know, just little things like that that really helped.
We have an email that's come in. I wonder what it was like to achieve almost iconic status at such a young age. Did you not realize that until later? For me, Robin writes, this was one of the few movies that got the book right, and it is a perfect book. Mary? What do you think of that, Charles? Mary?
Well, I asked Mary one time when we were together in Monroeville. I said, what impact did this movie have on you? No, that's not what I said. I said, what would you say to Harper Lee if you could meet her right now? And she said, I would say, thank you for giving me a life.
Thank you for giving me a life. Woo!
Isn't that remarkable?
Woo!
Yeah, you have to understand, she was just a little girl, you know, and it set the course of her life. She was the youngest person ever nominated for an Academy Award at that time.
My, that is quite something, isn't it? And what about you? You've spent a lot of your life involved in writing the biography. You don't have access to Harper Lee, so you spent a lot of time doing this. Did you read it in high school or younger, and you were just dumbfounded by it?
I read it in a socially engineered community outside Chicago that was set up for GIs and their families after the war.
Really?
Where you had to file an application to get in. And ideally, you had to be married, you had to be college educated, and you had to be a veteran. I knew no minority kids. And so I read this book, and I it was like reading about a foreign country. And like a lot of kids today, you know, I had difficulty with the first 5 or 6 pages. So what I tell teachers is, tell them that that's the way people get to know each other in the South.
Mm.
They relate by where you're from,
right,
who you're related to,
right,
and how long you've been in this area. And you just have to get past that because it's the Southern leisurely pace of getting to know someone, and that's the way the book starts out.
And that's, yeah, it sure does. Thank you, Charles, so much for being with us. We thank Mary for joining us for a few moments as well. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for a great deal of work in producing this program. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing On Air here from downtown Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. So here's to seeing this movie again, or reading this book again, on the 50th anniversary of the book To Kill a Mockingbird.